Hi.
This is the United States calling. Are we reaching?
Everyone got it.
All right, we ready to start? We're all sitting up here. There's people out there. Are we ready to start this thing? All right. Let's go ahead and do this with the usual poll here. Go ahead and put your hands up if you've seen War Games. Maybe I don't even need to go any farther. I guess we've seen Sneakers, seen that as well. How many people have seen Hackers?
I've tried to.
And you're willing to admit it. Oh, okay. How about Takedown? Anyone seen Takedown? Takedown? A couple people seen Takedown? I guess, they pretend to be hacker movies, but they're all crap, basically. It ain't like that. There you go, entertainment. It's Hollywoodized. It's hacking isn't
has about as much to do with hacking as Indiana Jones has to do with archaeology.
What? I didn't hear that.
It has about as much to do with hacking as Indiana Jones has to do with archaeology.
There you go. I like that. That's a good analogy. Am I the only one who's going to be talking here? I mean, do I talk? Okay,
well, you took the floor, so we're waiting on you to finish.
The floor, okay.
If we wait for him to be finishing, we'll be finishing.
I got to pretend I'm rattling, make up.
No,
and just
please.
Not stop talking ever.
If you pick up a chair, we're throwing you out.
All right. Who brought the stopwatch?
I don't know. Anyone know where the phrase hacking came from? Where it first originated? It actually goes back quite a bit. I don't know if it went back quite that far. The first usage that I'm aware of occurred at MIT back in the 50s. A bunch of guys who were really, really into model trains of all things, but this being MIT, they couldn't do a real simple model train layout. No. They had to have a multi-layered network switched with stolen phone equipment that they would use to run their trains on different tracks and different schedules and try to keep them from crashing and everything. These were the first guys who wanted to really play around with computers at the time when a computer would probably fill a room about this size and was guarded by the IBM acolytes. And the only real exposure you got to the computers where you could go in with your punch cards and give them to the IBM guys. And maybe they would feed them into the computer in the next day or so, or maybe not. You just kind of kept checking back with them, and they would tell you if your program worked or not. Other than that, no access. You didn't get to touch the machines, didn't get to play with them or anything. So being industrious and clever students, these guys who really wanted to learn how the computers worked and tried legitimately to get access to the documentation, the information, at least get the IBM guys to show them the computers. When all their legitimate means failed, they did what any industrious college student would do. They started breaking into the computer labs at night and playing with the stuff. That's how you learn. Hands-on imperative. And that's pretty much where hacking came from. I'm going to stop and let someone else take over for a second, or should I keep going?
Well, I'll add a little bit more to the history. Actually, it wasn't just college students that were hacking around with it. There were a lot of professors' kids or kids just from the local Cambridge area who just came in. I mean, you know, you had 12-year-olds who were going in and just messing with what was known as the TIXO, and later it was the PDD-6 and then the PDD-7, and a lot of them made a lot of good careers out of it. Some of them went on to go on to MIT. Even though the weird thing is a lot of these students that were messing around with the computers, that's all they did. They didn't even go to class, a lot of them, and MIT would drop them, but they didn't care because what mattered to them was just hacking on the machine. They found their purpose in life. Once they did that, who cares if they made all less? They could find another job doing something that they really enjoyed as long as they can just be next to the machines. That was the whole point of the endeavor.
It wasn't a malicious thing. They didn't want to break stuff or tear things up. They wanted to learn. This was a new toy, a complicated system to play with. Another
quick pop quiz. Who here has got the impression from the media that hacking necessarily implies a criminal activity?
Better than that, who thinks they can define hacking? Where's our little microphone, our moving microphone?
Over here. He's dressing his
okay, who thinks they can define hacking? Who wants to give it a shot? Come on, be the rebel.
No, we want to.
All right, they're all going to be passive.
Oh, there's one. Okay, we got one here.
If this was hacking 201, we'd throw you a beer right now.
Yeah,
okay. Tomorrow night.
Hacking is basically finding a new and interesting way to use an existing system.
finding, you know, figuring out how to use it without the documentation.
Yeah. He's been to these before.
Breakneck attendant.
Yeah. Hacking is it doesn't necessarily have to be a computer system. Any process of learning something that is not a conventional means is hacking.
Or freaking if it has to do with phones. Big pastime in the 60s.
Yeah.
Satellites are still legitimate targets.
Satellacking, maybe?
I have some better ones, though, we'll talk about near the end of the panel.
If any of you have ever found a loophole in the IRS and gotten $10 back more than you thought you were supposed to, that's hacking. Yeah, they don't have any of those. What, 10,000-page document now?
If you want to see like the what's pretty much the standard definitions, pick up one of the Hacking 101 flyers. We've got, where are they, on the tables over there? I've got the definitions from the jargon file for hack, hacker, and hacker ethic on the back there. On the front are a bunch of fun links to play with. It'll kind of get you into what hacking is and is not about. Keep in mind that I did this flyer last year because I wasn't sure if I would even be attending this year until about 48 hours ago. So some of the links may be outdated or old, and you can consider it a challenge to figure out which ones are still good and where the obsolete ones have moved.
And if you can't read it, see your eye doctor.
Can I make a quick announcement? Okay. Since we are recording this for the FGA website, if you want to make a comment or ask a question, please raise your hand and please speak to the microphone. Because people are listening to this off the website, it's not going to make sense if they're responding to some questions and that no one hears. So think of it this way, it'll be recorded for posterity.
Trying to remember the military definition of hacking, which was malicious code put into a system for other than its original intent. Or at least that's what it was in the first question when I was in the military.
That's absolutely and totally wrong. That's more. Are you sure that wasn't the definition of a virus or a Trojan or? Yeah. I wish Cheshire Catalyst could be here. He did some wonderful things with the military in the 60s. He used to hack on the satellites, the Russian satellites, and connect them to U.S. ships, and then talk to the ship guys. And
I got to pay for my hotel room somehow. So $10, cheap.
Our Pope the Pimp, our Pimp the Pope, however you want to say that.
Master of marketing.
Vicious self-promoter.
Why don't we go over who's here? We can start at the end with James Dean.
Oh, gee, why do I get to start? I'm a straight guy.
Because we love you.
actually, kind of looking at the two ends of this table, we're probably pretty much arranged that way, aren't we?
It's kind of like a spectrum, I think.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, James Dean is my real name. I have enough trouble trying to convince people of that, but I normally don't bother with a handle. In real life, my day job consists of systems engineering, so you might say in a lot of ways I turned an interest in hacking as a teenager into a fairly successful career. And that's true of a lot of people who start out just being curious and then discover they have a love of the technologies and want to turn it into a lifelong career.
Blither, continuing graduate student, well, professional student over at University of Georgia. And right now, I'm considered to be the tech guru in my department, but that's only because I know how to connect a printer cord to the actual box.
Is this a Microsoft shop? I'm Dragon. I'm a network engineer for one of the other, another convention in the area. It's AtlantaCon. It's a hacking con, sister con to Freaknik con. Well, he's hiding in the back right now.
I'm hawking t-shirts. I'll be up in a minute.
Hawking something.
Well, it's not terrible.
Well, that was very informative. Okay. I'm Rhiannon. Cat, whip, whatever you want to call it, for the AtlantaCon. I also am in cradle-to-grave support hell for a rather large international corporation here. I'm basically kind of the odd one out on the panel in a different way, just to prove that not all hackers are 15-year-old boys.
Uh,
protected by a dragon by fans.
Go by Disturbed. Also help with the AtlantaCon convention, and yeah, Disturbed is quite appropriate. But especially of late, working where I'm working now, it's basically just a generic solutions provider, which we wind up having to beat our boss over the head to get him to actually understand what we're trying to sell. And but the other work I do is basically with the AtlantaCon convention and help with organization and some of the network layout, mostly physical.
He will also be presenting a panel Monday on some of the experiences that he has run across with the legal system and a simple port scan.
I'm Hugme. If I have my own fan club. If you don't know who I am, you've probably never been to a convention before. I've been working on computers since I can remember. When I was in... Yeah, and what did I do last night? Jeez. When I was in third grade, our school got one computer. It was an original Apple. I started showing up at the door to meet the principal to unlock the doors so I could get in and start working on the app on the computer as soon as I got there, before the sixth graders would come and beat me up and throw me off. Some of it, yeah. A little fighter pilot game. Death Track, if you ever played Death Track. From there, I got my first computer. It had a whole 2K of memory. I saved up my allowance for 2 months, spent $60 to buy a module for it that was 16 kilobytes. You'll hear about expensive memory. Now I've got calculators that have 10 times that, at least. They're Palm Pilots with 128 meg of memory and a 40 gig drive. It's ridiculous. It did not have a hard drive. My first program I ever wrote, I spent about 3 weeks writing it, and I didn't have any medium that I could put the program onto because they had cassette recorders then. I couldn't afford a cassette recorder. So I had it all set up on my TV. I got all ready to run it, and the first command that I sent it, it was an old language called Pig Basic. The first command I sent it, I meant it for it to clear the screen. However, I sent it the command to clear the memory. So yes, I spent many, many hours sitting and writing programs that, well, really sucked. From there, I started playing around with different things. Discovered BBSs. I'm sure many of you are familiar with BBSs. Yes, I had a 300 baud modem. They were a lot of fun. When I got my 1200 baud modem, my first words out of my mouth were, "Wow, I can't even read that fast." I used to set up downloads that would take 3 or 4 days. I'd be downloading flat files. Yes, ASCII Prawn. Did some playing with NASA a little bit. In 19... 1995, I got in a little bit of trouble with the CIA. The problem with what I did was everything I did was completely legal when I took CIA.gov and pointed it at my website. They were kind of pissed off, but they couldn't do anything because they were the ones that signed the paperwork to have it done. From there, I'm now work for Scientific Atlanta. I do encryption. I'm the reason you can't steal cable anymore. Not our cable, you can't.
That sounds like a challenge.
I'm the reason y'all can't steal cable. and yeah, I'm a hacker. And now we go to Johnny X.
Hi, I'm Johnny X, and I'm also now officially Hugme's roommate. We have a house together, which means things are going to get really damn weird.
Be afraid.
All right,
very,
I'm telling you.
Very afraid.
44 computers, is that what you got? All right, he's got 44 computers. I think right now, I'm not sure, because I'm still... No. We got more than that. I got about 14 computers I can bring online immediately, but from the parts, I think I could probably build another 24 or so. So needless to say, we're going to have a very large electric bill.
Obligatory line. What would a Beowulf cluster of those actually do?
Well, some of this stuff is like, you know, the Franklin Ace 1000, the bootleg Apple II computer that came out in 1983, which was, in fact, my first computer and seems to have set the tone for the rest of my computer career.
I only count mine if I can network them.
I think I could network this thing. But, yeah, I got first computer in 1983, and it was a bootleg Apple II. I was very popular in school because I was the only guy who could read both Apple and PC floppies, so I did a lot of courier-type work. Got my first modem in 1984, yes, after watching War Games and mowing about 1,000 miles of lawn that summer, and it was 110 and 300 baud, which totally kicked ass. Got my first internet access in 1985. Got my first legal internet access in 1986. Actually didn't get a job doing anything computer-related. I was pretty much just a user up until about 1994 or something like that, and been making a living at it ever since, although I am currently unemployed right now and desperately need employment that does not involve would you like fries with that or paper or plastic type questions. So... grab the resume, grab several, pass them around. Anyone who gets me employed, I'll cover all your expenses for Freaknik 5 the first weekend in November, except for airfare, because that's a little bit too much for me right now. But maybe that's even negotiable. We'll find out.
And then see me for the documentation on how to manage a hacker.
Professional cat herder.
Yeah. I'm the guy who does Freaknik up in Nashville each year. Originally it was several other folks, but they wised out and bailed out very quickly, and so now I'm the only idiot who's still willing to volunteer to handle and coordinate everything. Been involved with the 2600 chapter up there since about 1993, and that's about all I have to say right now. I like messing around with hardware and phone systems, and I guess it's about time I finally learned to program.
How many of you have used an alternative operating system before? I mean by alternative, wow. Well, I guess most of you know what it is then, huh? Minix, Linux. Oh, we actually have a Minix person here. I thought I was the only person to use Minix. Minix is a wonderful operating system.
Amiga.
Oh, we have...
Nothing wrong with
that.
Yeah,
BOS is a neat one. Okay, anyone with Linux? You have Linux users? Okay, put your hand down if you use Red Hat. Oh, okay, wow. Wow, we have some.
BSD?
All of those help files you wrote for BSD? Those are all mine. I don't know, did they?
Some people pay for therapy, Hug Me writes help files over there.
We're running BSD here now. Fortune minus O is a wonderful thing, especially if you put it on a corporate environment. O is offensive fortunes only.
Just to change the topic slightly, who here has heard of TAP or Yipple, YIPL magazine? All right, a couple people, cool. I would just like to say that last year I brought several copies for people to look at. This was probably the first hack freak zine that came out, started by Abby Hoffman, in fact, in 1971, ran up to about 1984, and then 2600 came out. And whoever stole the set that I brought last year, I just want you to know that you've set back the project I had of scanning all this stuff and putting it online for free. Probably by about a year, because you also took all of my notes that I had in that copy, and if I ever find out who you are, I will hurt you very badly, unless you want to give the stuff back. It's a chance to be honest here. I'm going to do worse than that.
How many of you read 2600?
Oh, cool. A few.
Yeah. 2600 is a really neat magazine you can pick up at most local bookstores. We're all a member of a group. We a little offshoot of 2600 we call SE 2600, which is southeast of the U.S. And it's got a little generic stuff, simple hacks that have come out recently, news in the hacking community. How many of you have heard of Dimitri? Oh, good. Good. I was there for the eBooks panel and when he was arrested. So please write your congressman. Tell them that DMCA is really dumb. Anyone else have anything to talk about before we go into questions? We like to do most of this panel for questions because people tend to have a lot of questions for us.
I got a final comment here. I mentioned earlier direction for hackers in the hacking community. When you think about it, we've pretty much achieved all the goals that we set for ourselves all these years ago. We've got access to very powerful, very cheap computing equipment. We've got access to phone equipment. We've got Internet access. Most of us have got fast Internet access. We've got free and open source operating systems. There's not a whole lot else that needs there aren't that many more needs or goals that we really need to go after as far as technology is concerned. Hacking is about exploring and fixing, if you find inefficiencies, complicated systems. And I would like to toss out a proposal here. Other people have mentioned it and explained it better than I probably will, Jello Biafra among them. But in case you haven't noticed, our legal system and our political system are totally fucked up right now. And I would like to propose to y'all that law and government are two very, very complicated systems that are in desperate need of open sourcing and fixing. And about the only power we really have is who we elect and who we put into office. And until we start putting the right people into office or perhaps putting ourselves into office, I think things are going to get worse before they get better. So think about that. Please think about that. One of the things I'm doing when I move down here is I've gotten so disgusted with the situation that I am going back to school. I am studying law classes. I am going to get a law degree. And I used to joke a lot that the problem with judges is that they all used to be lawyers. I'm setting my goals pretty high. I realize there's
Johnny X for president!
I realize there's a very slim chance I'll ever be on the judicial bench. I think politics are a little bit too sleazy. My standards haven't fallen that low yet. But we'll see what happens.
You moved in with Hug Me. Give it time.
Think about what could happen if people like us were calling the shots and running the show. Think about that really hard. And I encourage you to follow up on those ideas and those thoughts.
Look at the federal government and the IRS and consider, could it possibly be any worse?
How could we possibly do any worse? Really?
Look into the Libertarian Party.
Or the Green Party.
Yes.
The old joke is that Libertarians could be considered nothing more than pot-smoking Republicans. We're going to have some interesting political discussions, Hug Me and I are.
Battle of the third parties. At this point, we will open it up to questions. For those of you who thought, how many people think you can't do graphics on a Unix box? New install. I installed this.
For 10 years.
Or more.
Who's got
questions? I'm going to be bringing up some odd stuff here, so...
Let's get Mr. Hunter S. Thompson here.
Thank you. I'm going to be out of character for this, if I may. But my question revolves around the recent, cracking. I hesitate to call it that because it was so trivial, of the WEP encryption for wireless Ethernet. And I was wondering what the panel's thoughts are on that and the future of the 802.11 standards, because, B obviously is insecure, and... will A be better, or are there other standards that are going to be created to be? Because I wanted to jump into that, because I'm into ham radio and I'm into computers at the same time, and it really interested me. But I'm hesitant to experiment now because I don't want to invest in several hundred dollars worth of hardware that's going to be, you know.
Yeah, you're asking about the security of the hardware.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
As far as you want yourself to be secure, your communication with something else to be secure, or you're worried about other people hopping on your network?
I'm mainly worried about the security of, let's say, contacting my home computer from a portable with the from a long distance, you know, having a network and a different, you know, Ethernet bridges.
For as far as the communication, use secure packages. Use SSH.
Right.
I mean, there are tons of secure packages that you could for communication, for your email, for everything. Start using PGP. Don't bother relying on the hardware for that.
I just wanted multiple layers because I would use SSH if I wanted to connect to the machine. But, I mean, that's only one layer, and I was thinking, you know, it'd be nice to have the hardware encryption functioning and not being so, you know,
like any security question, it really evolves down to, you know, what's your level of paranoia, what's your need for security. I run 802.11b at home. I'm only running 64-bit hardware encryption, but the only systems that are on there are mine. I don't keep any critical data on that network. You know, it would take you a fair amount of time to sit there and crack that, even with the weaknesses in the encryption scheme, because quite frankly, I'm not passing that many packets backwards and forwards on the network, particularly log-on, log-off packets, which are the ones you need to sniff to get the access key. So from that perspective, it's practically fairly secure for home use. The biggest problem with the encryption keys on, you know, 802.11b actually is in the workplace, with people doing what we now are calling war driving, like war drive dialing with modems used to be, going hanging out in the parking lot on a corporate LAN with 802.11b access, where there are a lot of people logging on and off. Get stiff a lot more packets, that's a lot more insecure.
That's kind of what I was going to suggest, too. You may want to have just a small network at home to play with this separate from your main network, and also go ahead and be on the attacking side, cruise around the business districts or campuses where you know the stuff is being used and see what you can do.
Most companies that are in that situation that actually do know what they're doing, which are very few.
Look into a program. Look into a program called PopTop.
Yeah.
It's a really nice VPN program. That you can put some pretty heavy encryption. I think it'll go up to 256 now. And it can actually run over SSH as well. So with PopTop, it's a VPN connection, so you never have to log on, log off, things like that.
Is there a URL for that?
Just go into a search engine, type in PopTop. Okay. Go to Google.
VPN is virtual private network for anybody who doesn't know. Next.
I was just curious. We already determined all these movies don't represent hacking in any real shape or form, but it's great entertainment. So tell us what it would really take to hack into something like, say, a credit agency. You don't like what they're saying about your credit, you want to change it. What would that actually entail? Would it be like a day or week or...
Oh, we've got advice for you on that.
Yeah, you were talking about more than we could cover in this panel and for the rest of Dragon Con.
It could be anything. You know, you could actually try to crack in the network, or you could actually, say, try to get a job working there and walk out with a computer that has a lot of stuff on it, which has happened in the not-too-distant past. They're actually, if they're bad things on your credit that shouldn't be there, and I advise everyone to check your credit reports fairly regularly because most of them, like 60 to 70%, do have errors on them. There are a lot of legal ways you can fix that. A lot of easy legal ways to fix that.
Yeah, the first thing you should do, go to clarkhoward.com and read. Reading is a hacker's best tool. There are plenty of ways that you don't have to get into the very technical side of hacking. You can, do it legally.
I was just curious about, now that we determined the movies are full of crap, more of a realistic approach in letting...
Okay, leaving aside...
Social engineering is a wonderful thing.
Okay, I for a living, I help design systems to resist crackers, and really, it's all over the map. It really depends on how smart the management at that company are, how much money they're prepared to spend on smart security people, how intelligently they're prepared to set up their business to respond to problems, all of those things. I mean, it's all over the map. It's kind of like saying, you know, how well would a company or, you know, an organization respond to a hurricane?
At the same time, it could be also as lucky as you just happen to be the person that has the email address or your email address in their address book, and they get hit with one of these email bombing worms, and it sends out their critical information, and you could be hacking a site without even knowing it.
Thank you, Outlook Express.
They give you two quick websites to check, at least for the some of the very simple things everyone can do. Junkbusters, that's all one word, .com, and privacy.org. Those are two very good sites. I don't know if I put them on the 101 or the 201 flyers, but I recommend everyone check those sites out. And if you want to see a movie that actually is not terribly technically accurate but gives you a good idea of the mindset of hacking and really getting into tackling a hardware or software problem, Pi, P-I, check it out.
Excellent.
Junkbusters, all one word, .com, and privacy.org. Lots
also
of good material and good links on both those sites.
Also, never discount the factor of luck. I mean, a lot of break-ins that happen because, you know, enough people tried it and somebody got lucky, as opposed to somebody who was necessarily particularly skillful. That's something else you don't see in the movies.
Over the last year or two, there's been a lot of cable DSL router firewall products that have hit the market. You can buy them at Walmart and other places now. And I was just wondering, assuming you've configured them properly, how secure are these router firewalls? Are they easy to crack into, or are they pretty safe for your home network?
Okay. I designed these things. Cable modems. Cable modem can very easily be put into promiscuous mode. When you take a cable modem and put it into promiscuous mode, everyone on your sonnet ring or your loop, which is going to be everyone in your neighborhood and probably a few neighborhoods around you, all of a sudden every piece of data that they send in or out, you can also view.
at the same time,
look up. When you buy them at the store for the cable modem, just look up the documentation into it.
These pocket firewalls, the ones you can find in most stores nowadays, normally they're only as secure as the company is willing to put out updates and patches. Before you buy one, the best thing is to go to the manufacturer's site, find out when the last time they sent out a patch for it. If that date is longer than 3 days, 4 days, don't get it.
But they shouldn't have to. The DMCA will protect it for them, right?
Not only that, but a firewall is only as smart as its users.
Think of it as wearing a seatbelt when you drive. It's a good thing to do, but is that going to save your life if you hit the concrete at 120 miles an hour? No. Okay, same thing. It'll deter sort of casual script kiddie type of hacks, but not much else.
With the DSL, it's Direct Connect. You can still put it in promiscuous mode, and depending on the ISP you're connected to, some ISPs don't even bother using switches. They use hubs, which mean everyone plugged into that hub gets all the information. But they figure no one's going to know how to put it into promiscuous mode. A lot of administrators work on the concept of my users are dumb, which is not a bright thing to do because of the people in this room.
But it's a standard support philosophy.
We like to play with things. We like to put things in modes that they're not made for.
Let's try this and see what happens.
You asked about cable modem, DSL, and something else, didn't you? Okay.
Linux Router Project. That'll get you started, if nothing else. Linux Router Project, one word, .org, I believe.
If you go to hugme.org, my name, hugme.org, I've got a lot of information on very basic how to set up a firewall, and you can do it with a 386 with two network cards. You can find 386s in dumpsters all over the place. drop two network cards in it. From the documentation I have hundreds of people who've used the documentation on my site. It's very easy to follow. I try to make it as user-friendly as I possibly can. I try to explain how a NAT system works, where you have internal addresses that can't route over a network, and then you don't use your routing machine for anything else. It's very hard to break into a system like that because you have to break into your NAT machine before you can see anything else on the network.
Something like home networking for dummies isn't a bad start either.
What kind of future do you see for bioinformatics on alternative OSs? Bioinformatics, dynamic DNA processing, sociology.
Oh,
You mean like distributed computing type systems where there's a company that's actually...
Things like the Blue Gene Project?
Yeah, it's buying time on your system to research.
Yeah, things like that. Also, running programs to compute sociology studies.
Protein folding and things like that?
Yeah, I had a job interview, and I'm very good friends with a company who does this, and they're using Next. They're using all Next hardware and software.
Wow.
Yeah, they went through and configured it themselves. The thing about DNA, when you start really getting into DNA scanning, there is so much information. There is so much information in the DNA, it's hard to really take any machine that is a generic machine and use it for scanning DNA. What most companies are doing, like theirs, they take a operating system and they will totally rewrite it, and it will be directed towards them, towards what they're doing. You know, in their case, they're going over DNA in a virus. So all their software does, all it will do, is go over the DNA in the virus. It's a closed system, so you're not able to do anything else with it. That's it's unfortunate you can't do anything else with it, but it's very fast at what it does. Open source is a wonderful thing to use for that because it is open source. You can change anything you want. However, it's limited to the hardware. So as far as bio stuff, as far as scanning, being able to do scans like that, I see it going totally hardware just for that reason, because there's so much information, there's so much that needs to be processed.
I mentioned BlueGene as a project. You can look them up on the net. I don't know what the URL is. They're a prime example. The primary system for doing DNA decode and protein folding synthesis is highly parallel. In other words, it's got lots and lots of processors all doing the same operation on separate bits of data simultaneously. That's a very different architecture from a standard computer. But what they are, so it almost mandates a custom written OS, as Agni said. But essentially, what a lot of the sites are doing are, in front of this massive parallel engine, they have standard machines, which are basically front loaders for the data that feed it in and take the results out and massage it back into some semblance that humans can read. Most of those are based on open operating systems, simply because writing code for custom specialized parallel processors to interface with them is a lot easier in an open environment.
Yeah. And open systems have more. He's talking about a Beowulf cluster, and open systems have more information on a Beowulf cluster than any other system. So it was originally written by NASA on Slackware. So,
well, one quick question. I saw that you had Slashdot listed under trusted news sources.
Trusted for what? We didn't say.
Good point. My question is about the 2,600 meetings and hacker activism and activity throughout the country and the world. I've been going to my local 2,600 meeting for I don't know how long. I have a history similar to some of what you guys have described, starting with the old CPM homebrew machine in about 1978 when I was 12.
I can see the gray hairs from here.
People who have that kind of a history are into this stuff. They do what we do. They know what we know. People who came in later, when there already were PCs with Windows and what have you, do not seem to share our views, our interests, our method of approaching this stuff. And I'm curious where you see the future of hacking going as it moves to a new generation beyond us.
As far as the new generation goes, there's a couple of kids that we've actually had at some of our conventions. One of them goes by the name of Optics. He's like 21, 22 years old now. Probably one of the most brilliant minds I've ever run across. He's extremely sharp. He thinks in machine code.
He has memorized the Linux kernel in hexadecimal. The way, not hexadecimal like you would compile it and you get hexadecimal. No, hexadecimal running. So the way it looks in memory.
I've met lots of smart kids, too, but they're not hackers, not in the sense that we mean. What I'm talking about is there has been no new member joined the Triangle North Carolina 2600 group in, like, 3 years.
We're all committed to it. We get a lot of new ones here at ours.
Yeah, we get tons at ours.
Okay.
Come on. Bring them in. Publicize them.
Yeah, the biggest problem with 2600 is they don't have a media department. There's no advertising.
Well, it's a magazine.
Well, they're advertising. People are going, ooh, that's a cool magazine. Check it out.
Coming from someone who's more from the tail end of it, as you speak, granted, my first computer was a BIC 20, for God's sake, but it was nowhere near in the world of a Trash 80. I've kind of looked into that myself and tried to wonder and even fit into the old school. But what I've seen basically is that a lot of the originals, the people that really got in it from the beginning, see it more from a scientific viewpoint. It's all code, it's all numbers and everything else, whereas a lot of the people that are just now getting into it see it not so much just as the code, but more as it's more of a psychology. It's kind of a, you get along with your machine like it's a friend. There's a union of, you know, kind of a camaraderie between you and your machine, if you will.
Computer is part of the culture.
Yeah, and that's really, I mean, there's still the dedication for a lot of the new ones that are stepping in, but the way they view their computer is, it can be completely different.
And there's also optics of sight. They don't have to go through a whole lot of the old school of actually like setting the bits and the bytes by hand. They don't have to sit there and figure out how to make sure the country cards are exactly right and in order. All that's already long past. Everything is so transparent for a lot of it that they've transcended that point, and people coming in now don't have to see that. They can take it from here and go forward. So on some hands, they're missing some of the history, so sometimes they may not be quite as responsible until after they start stumbling around. On the other hand, they're not as bogged down by prejudice and preconceived notions. The machine has now become an integral part of society where it used to be, you know, way off on the fringe and only a few select people could ever even dream of touching one. So everything evolves, and so is this.
Look for the folks, too, who are more interested in learning how this stuff works and what non-standard things you can do with it than the kids who just want to find the latest scripts and exploits and free porn and MP3s online. There are people out there like that. You just kind of encourage it. Yeah, a good question to ask is, all right, what's the most interesting screw-up or mistake that you've made recently, and what have you learned from it?
And how big a crater did it leave?
Speaking as one of the new generation just entering hacking, moving from user to hacker, I'd like to note that there are a lot of different mindsets, and some of us will grow up into the older mindset that's more scientific. Some are just playing around, but I think that we have to have time to mature just in our mindset as a whole before we can really be judged on how we're dealing with hacking.
That's a good point. I mean, there's a lot of cases where, as you get older, you tend to forget how much you've learned and how much you struggled with certain things right at the beginning. I mean, that's certainly true for myself. I don't know how everybody else feels.
Yeah, we all pretty much – I know when I was younger and first getting into computers at hardcore, I was as destructive too. I programmed a program on an Apple that sent a peek and a poke code to every potential port all the way up the stack on an Apple II to see what it would blow up. It was pretty too.
It's all about just playing with stuff and seeing what you can learn. And
being afraid to, go ahead and set it up yourself. Set up your own little network loop at home. What got me actually into it myself was I kept crashing the damn things, and I wanted to figure out why, how, and how to make it stop. And basically the old adage of know your enemy.
That's why you run Linux now.
Yeah, I run Linux now because I'm tired of rebooting systems. Last time I had to reboot my system is when we moved.
As far as who's a hacker and who isn't, I don't think it has a whole lot to do or as much to do as with what you know as with what you're willing to learn, what you're willing to try, and what kind of information you're willing to share. If you've got an open mind and you're willing to play with stuff and talk to other people, that makes you a much more interesting person than someone who's been doing this for 20 years and has got a leader-than-thou attitude and doesn't want to talk to you because you've only been into it for a couple of years. Fuck those people. Who needs them, you know?
you have a tremendous advantage right now if you're getting into it as well, because, I mean, you know, instead of screwing around with something and taking a risk with a $5 million piece of equipment, now it costs $500. Okay, you know, the stakes are just that much lower. So you're starting to see much more risky so-called activities amongst kids at an earlier age, poking and prodding around with things because of that.
Now that and it also doesn't take 3 days to compile something.
Yes.
Well, that and think about who starts into hacking. Most of the time, it's going to be somewhere around the 14, 18-year-old range. This is a very powerless time in which maybe, you know, you feel a sense of empowerment knowing that you can manipulate this code and knowing that you can actually affect other things, sometimes maliciously, sometimes not, is a great feeling. But at the same time, sooner or later, you do start, like the point you said, at one point, you're going to start to mature, and you want to actually build things and not destroy things. And building the program and compiling it is a power in of its own right. So.
And if you're not 13, it's not too late to start learning.
Never too late. Next question. Anyone? Oh, come on.
Come on, brave people here.
Bueller.
I know what it is. Bueller. We haven't been giving up.
The words of Albert Einstein, I am not smarter than anyone else. I am only passionately curious. That defines a hacker.
I was wondering if you could comment about Windows XP and how secure it is and the socket layer. And
troll.
put a sieve in your sink and see how much water it holds.
It's Microsoft. What more do you need to know, man?
It's very secure. It is the most secure operating system I've ever used because, well, you can't boot it.
Well, out the door, but...
don't connect it to anything else and you'll probably be okay.
Turn it off, put it in the safe, and bury it.
If you've ever heard of someone called Sardistic, he's a Windows hacker.
He doesn't have to work too hard.
Yeah, he works for 2 months out of the year. He's the guy who wrote Back Orifice. He's the main programmer for Back Orifice. But if you go to Uber Hackster, I think he still has a link up there.
He should be on the Atlanticon.org website, too.
You can also go to cultdeadcal.org. He's on there. So
the issue that's been getting a lot of press in the TCP/IP stack type issue, I'll see if I can simplify this down to 30 seconds or less, is essentially giving programs that run on the system access to, if you like, the very low levels of the hardware so that you can send out anything over the wire. It's not supervised. But that kind of access has been accessible in every Unix system since the year dot. It's also been available in Windows 95, 98 type systems for a very long time. It's only been in NT and 2000 systems that filter was ever slapped in place. And that doesn't apply to anybody who's logged into the system with administrator privileges. So, no, it's not a good thing, but it's kind of like it's not a huge gaping security hole. It's more like somebody took the training wheels off.
One of the biggest, the largest exploits in Windows, Windows has a way of never checking. They put in little encryption stuff, and, yeah, that has a few exploits. But one of the biggest holes, Windows has never been able to check who logs into their system except by username and password. Man-in-the-middle attacks are just absolutely rampant for Windows systems. You can find thousands of them on the net. And I have that, I mean, looking at ME, looking at 2000, Sardistic did a basic overview of 2000. It gets worse in 2000. I mean, they aren't even bothering, you know, doing some kind of an RSA check or something like that. It's hideous. It really is. If you can get a couple of computers at your house, get a Microsoft box and a Linux box, and there's a little program called Snoop or Snort. And all they do is capture packets. Set the other one up as a Microsoft box. Start doing things with the Microsoft box. Open up a few things, try to connect to some things, and then just capture packets coming from that Windows box. You'd be amazed at the passwords you get off your own box. This is just two computers. Then you're watching it go back and forth between the traffic, and that's basically what Sardistic does when he goes to hack a Windows box or anyone else. That's one of the first places you look when you look for network exploits.
I don't bother to remember passwords on my Windows boxes because it's faster and easier to crack them.
Got a comment here. This isn't to encourage any type of illegal activity or anything, but it was noted as far back as 1995 at SummerCon, which was another hacker convention here in Atlanta, that pretty much as long as you're not committing any kind of toll fraud, i.e. you're paying all of your bills for your phone and your net access, and as long as you stay away from machines that are under U.S. jurisdiction, that you probably won't get in any trouble if you decide to play with machines that are under the jurisdiction of foreign governments, especially ones that we're not particularly friendly with, China. So once you know what you're doing a little bit more, if you want to poke around, not that I'm encouraging or advising this at all I'm saying is stay away from machines under U.S. jurisdiction, especially .mil and .gov. Especially.
And please try to bounce and don't it visit so the Chinese. Dukes don't come back here.
And don't visit the Chinese embassy anytime soon.
When you say U.S. jurisdiction, what do you mean exactly?
Exactly what I meant, U.S. jurisdiction. Anything that's controlled by a U.S. company or individual or government or agency. Machines belonging to individuals, organizations, or corporations under other nationalities tend to not really be that much of concern to our government, especially if it's a government that we're not on particularly good terms with.
And for a public service announcement, if you're running a Windows 9 Xbox 95, 98 ME, and you're on a public or a group network like a cable modem, DSL, do not in any circumstance whatsoever use any form of file sharing. The password system that they use for file sharing can be cracked faster than you can type in the password. I've watched a 20-character password be cracked in 10 seconds. The way it does it is it does a per-character authentication system. It first cracks the first character, then the second character, then the third character, and there's no timeout or limits. Yeah.
Just a useless bit of trivia here. Who's got a cable modem with At Home? Do y'all remember what your default password was? Change me. And I hear under good authority that's the default password for every single other at-home account. Not that I ever worked for them or anything. No, of course not. Hint, hint. And lots of people forget to change their passwords. But, yeah, that's U.S. jurisdiction, so you don't want to mess with that.
Question in the back.
Is it highly recommended, especially with DSL out now, that you actually use a Linux firewall or some other firewall? Probably Linux is what I've been using for 3 years now. But a Linux firewall with no services running on it, and of course you have the proper deny files and lockdowns?
It depends upon your level of capabilities. The best one out there, if you want hardcore locking down, yes, it's either Linux running the latest kernel running IP tables or OpenBSD. Both of them are based off IPFW, which is an extremely secure, extremely easy to configure once you get a way to understand it. If you're looking for an easy, quick install, you definitely want to turn off all your services. The only service or application you should have running from the outside connecting to that firewall should be SSH. SSH 2, not one. Definitely not one.
The part about skills is critical. I mean, a well-locked-down Windows box is more secure than a badly configured Linux or BSD box. I mean,
I have seen Linux firewalls that their entire code was accept all.
If y'all want to get an interesting look at security from the government and the military's point of view, this may be more Hacking 201 related, and I should have put this on the flyers. I'm kicking myself now for not thinking of this. The NSA, actually, if you go to their site, they've got some very interesting guides you can download for securing Windows 2000, securing Cisco routers, and also SE Linux. What does the E stand for? Secure?
Security Enhanced.
Enhanced Linux, yeah.
It's actually a patch for a Linux install.
Yeah, but there's a lot of documentation there. You can go through the code. It's very interesting stuff to look at to see how they regard security. The Navy also has a guide to securing Windows NT. I don't have the NSA, of course, is www.nsa.gov, and their security downloadable security guides are, I think, available on the top-level page there. Navy one you'll have to hunt around for a little bit, but if you do a Google search for, like, Navy securing and Windows NT, you should be able to find it.
And they're
very
free.
Interesting
tax
reads.
Dollars at work.
Yeah, it's also one of the best sites you can go to if you're looking for any kind of security information. They have a massive FTP site. It is open specifically for the purpose of distributing security information. They do not mind people browsing this. They want this. It's www.nsa.gov.
Their crypto library is fascinating, too. Check it out.
Although whether you trust their code or not.
Yeah, that was why I didn't install it.
Anybody else?
The NSA designed a hash function called SHA, and no one uses it because it's designed by the NSA, even though it appears to work just fine.
Yeah.
Use the MD5 hash instead.
Most security organizations or security groups of corporations, they don't use anything particularly that the NSA puts out, but they use the information to modify what they use.
The procedural documentation, if you're having to do with corporate or IT security, is particularly good to use as a model.
Yeah, the part of the NSA's job is to sit and find the most recent exploits, the most things like that. And under the Freedom of Information Act, they have to release that to the public. So it's a good place. Yes, exactly. So there you are. They're required to release all the information. So it's a great place to go to find exploits and patches for your own system, whether or not you download it from them, which I don't suggest, but it's a wonderful information source.
Who asked that question? I think that one was good enough for a beer. Yeah. Who asked that last question?
Back there.
No, that was a comment. Before that, the... Yeah, the Linux firewall.
Okay. You want a beer?
Are you over 21?
Yeah.
Have you got picture ID? Cool, come over.
I'll watch him open it.
I didn't shake it up that much.
But you can see.
All right. Any more questions?
We don't bite that bad.
Much.
Uh-huh.
Here we go. Yes, over here.
Okay, Mike.
Mike boy.
Over there. Over there.
His name's Mike.
I know.
I was curious about what the hacker community is doing to improve their shitty public image.
Oh boy.
Freaknik.org.
Atlanticon.
You said improve the public image.
Yeah.
Open it open to the public. What more do you want?
Routinely, you two opposite things at the exact same time.
Yeah, you're looking at it. Okay. I mean, that's why we're here.
Right.
That's one of the first things we went over was, this is us. What we're doing is looking for information. We're not evil people most of the time.
Right. I'd also challenge what you mean by hacker community. I mean, in a lot of senses, there is no such thing. There's a bunch of smaller groups of individuals that get together with specific sub-interests, but, trying to define it as a greater hacker community is kind of like just saying, the driving public. I mean, it's just way too broad.
Curiosity is not illegal.
Yet.
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 Yes.
Question?
Yeah, over here.
Yeah, we got one.
Mike boy.
Time to change the asbestos in those shoes.
Before we started this, he was 300 pounds.
How do you feel about the growing movement in hacktivism, and how are you personally involved?
How do you feel about what?
The growing hacktivism movement, and how are you involved?
Well,
I think they're very, very, very misguided in a lot of ways. I have actually been involved with quite a few of the different hacktivism groups, kind of as an advisor to quite a few of them. Unfortunately, they seem to be made up of two rather large and very distinct groups that have kind of somehow hit heads and come together. There's a lot of people who are brand new to computers who have just found out all these neat little exploits and stuff and are looking for ways to do so cleanly. And then we've got a lot of people who are activists on the outside. They're very active about carrying signs and posters and doing the whole protest out there. And they're trying to go to the next level, and they figure that using a computer is going to do so, but they have no concept of what a computer is actually for, how to use it. All they know how to do is to sit, here's this thing this guy gave me. I can click on it, and we can protest this area by taking down their website. Unfortunately, that's not exactly the best way to go about using technology to make your point. A lot of them have very high ideals. It's a long way to go for most of those groups until they get to the point where their ideals are going to actually hit some sort of true social responsibility.
Didn't you also bring up the point about you were the one who brought up about the young hackers replacing the old generation, or actually you were, or at least she brought up the point. Anyway, yeah, I think a lot of it... Oh, come. All right, that's pretty bad.
No, thank you. I've been boozed enough.
The booze for you.
All right. But no, seriously, I mean, think about it, though. A lot of people are new to the computer, and I would say they now feel as if they have new rush of powers, that now they can explore websites, now that they can actually build their first programs and so forth. And now they go into it, now they hear, they go to /dot, they hear about the DMCA, they hear about the CIPA with Child Internet Protection Act. And sooner or later, they feel as though even though they don't really have the base knowledge in order to kind of define themselves as a hacker, they still say, well, I'm a hacktivist. And once they do that, then they're going to go and probably do some things that might even be self-defeating.
I want to do one little side comment here that he just kind of triggered with me. We are so busy as a society today trying to save our children, that we're actually going to harm our children more than ever by killing their rights, taking away their freedoms, locking down their imagination, locking their curiosity, making it illegal to ask questions, making it illegal to question anything placed in authority. We are harming them by helping them. It's called killing them with kindness. So the next time you hear someone in the media saying something about, oh, we did this for the children, or think of the children, think about that very closely as to exactly what they're trying to accomplish. Are they actually trying to help the children, or are they trying to help their own agenda in some way? Because helping their own agenda a lot of times hurts the children and hurts our society. We are over-doping and over-enforcing the idea that imagination and activity and action and energy are wrong. And we're doing so by locking down the school systems, handing out drugs.
Sit down,
left and
shut
right.
up, and take your Ritalin.
Yeah, and anybody who's taken any type of psychotropic drug can never serve in the United States military. I find that rather interesting that our military would not trust anyone who's ever taken one of these drugs, and yet our government is sanctioning, oh, yeah, if they can't sit down and shut up, drug them.
They gave them a lot of things in Vietnam. Not nearly as bad as some of the things they gave themselves.
As far as hacktivism is concerned, I think in theory it's a pretty good idea, but it should be simply a subset of intelligent activism in and of itself, and you know, simply because, ooh, I have a computer and I can do all sorts of interesting stuff. If that's the only format in which you're willing to be active or an activist, I have some problems with that.
If you'll excuse me, I'm going to take the more hard-line, no-bullshit approach and say anybody who calls themselves a hacktivist is a poser.
That's good to me.
Next question.
Sure.
No,
201, tomorrow night.
Oh, let him ask. We'll make it quick.
What do you think of WinRoute Pro?
Win what?
WinRoute.
It runs on Windows, right?
Yeah.
It runs on Windows, right?
Well, like I said, I'm an NT admin. I don't have much choice about it.
Build a house foundation on a thing of yellow.
Stone him.
I feel your pain, so am I.
Next question.
I'll teach you.
Next question now.
Anyone up there think checkpoint certification is worth getting?
Any certification is worth getting.
Not MCSE, though, right?
You can sell
well, actually,
it to the
how much
you
are they going
to
pay you if you
management.
Get your,
you can
get your Microsoft cert?
Those letters will give you a lot more respect with the bean counters and management. At that point, you have more chance to make decisions, more control of what gets done. Whether or not you actually use those letters to do anything is irrelevant. It's all respect and getting things done.
It's a foot in the door, basically. A lot more HR people and, you know, pointy-haired bosses have heard of the Microsoft stuff than they have a CCIE or a CISSP.
Yeah, if you want a bit
If you can get someone else to pay for it, I'd say go for it, man. It couldn't hurt, you know, and you don't have to put it on your resume if you're going after Unix stuff.
Yeah, you can have all the little letters and numbers and anything else you want after your name. If you want to get true respect from your peers, you damn well better know what those things are actually standing for and how they work. I'm so tired of those most consult somebody else's that I have to work with.
Let me give you an idea. I'm a CCNA, Cisco Certified Networking Associate, and a RHCE, Red Hat Certified Engineer. I hate Red Hat. My last job paid for the class and the training. I took it. It got me out of a week of work.
I'll give you the other example. I have no certification after my name whatsoever, and I quite regularly wind up in headbutting competitions with people who are and beat them. Okay, so a certification is not about what you know. It's about who you're trying to impress. Well, it depends what you mean by professional. If you're trying to get hired by somebody who you know happens to value that certification or lists it as a minimum requirement, then hell yes, go get it. Yeah. If they don't value it, then fine.
It also depends. If you're just if you already have the knowledge and you're just going to take the test, that's good for promotions and for self-advancement. Now, if you're going to a week-long course to learn and he ends up giving you the test at the end of it, the information gained in the course is much more important than the certifications you get.
There's also the other side. I refuse to take certain MCSE tests simply because I view the answers that are given out as being wrong.
Okay,
they
are.
I refuse to give the wrong answer. Exactly.
Bottom line is
question in the back.
As far as I'm concerned, to be completely mercenary, if someone else is willing to pay for it and it gets me more money, sure, what the hell, I'll take it.
Yeah, it beats working for a living.
I actually want to make a comment from the standpoint of being an operations manager. Certifications tell me that you are familiar with some technical material, but if you have a certification and I don't see the experience to match up with it, I'm not hiring you. In a lot of cases, a certification is a very quick way for me to screen a resume and find out, oh, yes, you've dealt with a checkpoint. You've sat through the class. But I've got to see that you've had the year or two. You've installed 20 firewalls or you've worked as a security analyst for a couple of years before I start actually valuing that certification. Anybody can go to a class for a week, get the book, study them for a day or two, pass the test. Same thing with Microsoft certifications, probably anything except for the CCIE, which a lot of people seem to bow down to at this point.
Only because there's so few of them. I think there's still under a total of 6,000 of them in the world.
And there's actually a practical exam.
So do you actually get to see the resumes as they come in, or are they screened first before they get to you?
I was just laid off.
He wants a job.
I was just laid off.
No, that was an actual theoretical question. I think what you do is very good, but my question is, does this stuff have to go through a bunch of HR people and other folks before it gets to you, or do you get to see all the resumes at first and you make the decision?
All right, good question. All of a sudden, I'm on the other side of the panel.
This is called hacking the hiring process.
I have an interest in that right now.
Do we have another?
We have recruiters that will screen the resumes with criteria that we give them. So in the last company that I worked for, I managed a 24/7 operations center. We had 12 security analysts, 24 other personnel that did application server platform operations. If I'm hiring someone that's going to be managing checkpoint firewalls and intrusion detection systems, I'm going to tell a recruiter, I want people that have the CCSA and CCSE checkpoint certifications. I want someone with 2 years of networking experience of some sort, and I want some general security experience. And they'll go out and actually find things that match, and it may be an 80% match. It may be a very strong match. But they will take the candidates that actually pass that screening criteria, bring those to me.
Give the operations manager.
They'll actually pass the screened candidates on to me. We'll look at the resumes again, and then we'll have group interviews through their peers. Thanks.
My resume is on the table back there,
by the way. They've already ID'd
me in previous
conventions. What's that?
My resume is on one of those tables back there, by the way.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, it's up here, too.
We'll send you his.
There was an interesting discussion on our mailing list not that long ago about not only certifications but also the value of a university degree on the same criteria. And again, if your only criteria is, you know, what's going to get me hired, it's a question to get the certifications or study the fields that you know the people you want to hire you value and look for. Okay, now there are two levels of that. One is skills and experiences that will actually help you in the job, and the others are the foot in the door type things that will actually get you noticed and through the, you know, the filtering process in the first place. So really, that's what it boils down to. And again, there are people like my friend over here who study for the hell of it because they enjoy it.
What can I say?
Yeah, kind of an add-on to that one is basically it really kind of depends on what level you're wanting to step into this employment market at. And if you're wanting to step in at second and third level, hell yeah, you're going to need some background behind those letters. Otherwise, they're worthless. But if you're really wanting to get that entry level, just that foot in the door, you know, whatever, then, you know, that one guy, wherever he's managed to vanish off to, you know, there he goes. He's running away. Anyway, you know, even a simple MCP is an additional, you know, and a good foot in the door, anything. So, you know, don't just because, you know, yeah, Microsoft sucks, okay, but and the majority of the people out there that have MCSCs or MCPs, from what I've found so far, are idiots. They don't know what the hell they're doing. But majority. I'm even an MCP.
Next question.
Do you have any recommendations for if a company wants to try and find a security consulting company, what would be the criteria you would go by to identify who are good? Because there are so many of them out there who are planning to, you know, be in this marketplace. How do you?
Don't go with anybody whose site appears on attrition.org.
but realistically speaking, for a person who is, say, in IT, in a management role and wants to figure out what's the criteria to determine who is good and who is not so good?
Okay. The most important one is, have you even heard of them before? After that, you want to look at success stories. Usually, when you're dealing with companies like that, you're going to have a security audit or something like that done on that. Yeah, track record. Yes. Get references to other companies. How long have they been there? That's in the latest – in the IT world, that's really hard to say how long have they been there, because there's a couple of really, really good companies that haven't been there that long.
Security is a really funny thing. When you look for someone who is going to be a good security person, the number one thing you want to look for is, are they up on current events? Ask them about current patches. Ask them about current exploits, you know, for that system. To get into security, you companies talk about how they're having to change so quickly now because everything's, you know, moving so rapidly. Being a security person myself, it is really hard to keep up. I'm always about 3 days behind because I get 150 emails a day, and a lot of those are new exploits, new patches, things like that that I've got to go through and install and spend the first 3 or 4 hours of what I'm doing installing these patches, and then I've gotten more email about more exploits on more systems, you know, especially when you're running multiple systems. It's a lot to keep up with. You need someone who knows the news groups they need to go to, someone who has studied the operating system, who's on the mailing list. I do a lot of BSD, I'm on all the security BSD mailing lists. As soon as something comes out in them, I know about it. I've got it patched if it relates to me. It's very much into current events. Also, you're going to need to ask them, what is a buffer overflow? You know, basic. You're going to have to know both sides of it.
There's some questions you would not expect to be asking them. They'll probably get the most information from them. Find out how many hackers they hire. Find out how many black hats they hire. How many people are on their history have a history of being on the attacking side? A majority of your security people started out as getting in from the outside. There's a security individual I know that how he got his job was he dropped his resume on the desk of the CEO.
Literally on the computer's desktop, not on the desk of the CEO. The best way.
Yeah, the best thing that you actually have to think about when you're doing that, or hiring anybody in the IT industry, if you're going to be hiring any type of company to do any type of IT work, security included, you're going to have to take a little bit of responsibility and find out a little bit about what you're asking them to do. I mean, if you just walk in cold and go, I want a network, their dollar signs have gone off, and they're going to sit there, and it's business, especially since the first people you're probably going to be talking to are marketers. So you want to know at least as much as the marketers
said as well, which is very quickly, sorry, we're running out of time, is if you're talking about in-house stuff, it is a full-time job to secure even the smallest network. It is not something that your system administrator does during their lunch hour.
Something else that if you have your own security person that most people overlook, having a security person does two jobs. The first one is to maintain the fact that your network is secure. The second one is they're a consultant for everyone on your staff for whatever project they're doing to maintain a secure product. Most major corporations overlook this idea. They're putting out websites. The last thing they want to do is take it down, have their website take it down to the security individual to run an audit on it. If half of the companies did that, we wouldn't have half the problem we do with sites going down, getting hacked, because it would be done beforehand. We have one more question. We got about 5 minutes, 4 minutes left.
The gentleman in the front.
Yeah.
Quick follow-up question to that. I was wondering, you're talking about companies that audit security and stuff like that. Does anybody know, since they merged with AtStake or whatever, what's happened to the Loft, if any of their private projects are still up on the web? Because it seems to me that once you know it directs you to the AtStake site, now you don't see any of the Loft members' personal projects, and I'm just wondering what's happened to all that. I'm sure they show up at the cons, but otherwise... I actually didn't
even see him at DEF CON.
A lot of them went there. Legit.
Yeah, a lot of them have gone corporate.
Jeez.
So if you go through the AtStake site at all, you'll see them in suits and ties now.
Jeez, that's terrible. So,
it does pay to go to the dark side.
But they're getting paid really well.
It's too bad that we lost them.
They'll retire in a couple years, I'm sure.
Valuable resource.
I just wanted to see, you know, Senator Jesse Helms address the members of Loft, although it wasn't set up quite this way, but I would have loved to have seen the Honorable Mr. Dill Dog.
Okay, we got one more question. Anybody?
Somebody, come on.
Yes, you mentioned before how some of people have this newfound power. They just discovered hacking. Now they can take down websites at will, and boy, they feel great. But people like such as yourself who've been in a while, started a long time ago, and you know the nooks and crannies is not just a technical aspect, but you all have a sense of you can do this and you don't want to do this because this won't help us. Sure, we can take down your website, but is that going to help us? Who's going to teach these new people, you know, what's right and wrong? I mean, because hack, hack community.
Who taught us? I mean, when we were young and our parents told us not to do something, we did it anyway because we were being rebellious. We're being young. We get tempered with getting our hands burnt. It happens. It's going to happen for the rest of our lives. We're curious animals. It's the way we are.
But at the same time, some people say that there's no such thing as a hacker community because it's just like herding cats. But at the same time, I personally think there is a hacking community. And if enough hackers, which there are, go out and just say, don't do this. You know, all it does is just denigrate the community. You know, the whole point of being a hacker, and this goes to the core of the definition, is to build something. It is not to destroy. Once you build something, then you can have a mechanism by which you share knowledge and by which you can actually create a better programming mechanism and, who knows, maybe even a better world.
And a lot of it is teaching by example as far as not only just, you know, talking to them, but teaching by example because one thing...
So you're saying we're examples?
Yeah, we're great examples.
That's scary.
One of the things that holds out over time is that things are anything that's been constructed tends to last just a little bit longer than something that's been destructed. Because once it's been destructed, it's pretty much gone. So that's one of the best ways is to kind of teach them that if they really want to make a mark of something that they're constructively doing, and it'll stick around for a lot longer, and it'll make people think a little bit better of them, and their name will be actually up on the top a little bit faster.
People basically know the difference between right and wrong. I mean, you know, let's be honest here. Folks know if they're going out and taking down a website or defacing it that the people who own that site probably aren't going to be happy if they go ahead and do it anyway just because they can. Well, you know, that's my two cents.
I think
Okay. It's about time for us to wrap it up. We have one more little bit for you. A big round of applause first for our panel.
Hey, Huffy, how much you paying?
Hey, everybody, gather round. It's the privacy song. I don't have no privacy. Neither do you.
Oh, anyone who lives in Atlanta, we have an SE2600 meeting at Lenox Mall the first Friday of the month, starting at about 7.
And all of us will be here for the rest of the con. I think you pretty much know what we look like by now. If you got any further questions, just hit us up in the hallway.
Hey, everybody, gather around. It's the privacy song. I don't have no privacy. Neither do you.
Oh, I heard about that.
The government is watching us, and Walmart's watching too. Your doctor keeps your urine for to clone your DNA.